And trying to arrest him and failing would be even worse, Ducairn pointed out. His colleagues swiveled their gazes to him, and he shrugged. Think about it. If we order him arrested when we don't have any evidence he's done anything wrong, we hand him a ready-made pretext to turn against Mother Church. Faced with such serious false accusations, he'd simply be reacting in self-defense, and claiming our decision to arrest him as yet one more example of the corruption and capriciousness of Mother Church.
I really hate to say it, but I think Robert has a point, Clinton said heavily. As a matter of fact, it occurred to me to wonder if that wasn't exactly what Gorgia was trying to provoke me, us, into doing. If he really is ready and waiting, I mean. And let's face it, as Robert says, Taro is a long way from Zion. Father Franklin's a good man, but we can't possibly read the situation in Trangier from here without better information than he's been able to give us, so far at least. If I were Caleb, and if I could manipulate things to create a situation in which Mother Church drives Gorgia into his arms, for general consumption at least, I'd damned well do it. It would be one more way to make everybody who's still loyal to Mother Church nervous, not to mention the way it would play into that son-of-a-bitch Stonar's hands.
Ducairn squelched his smile before it ever got anywhere near his lips. He'd wondered how long it would take for Clinton's compulsive suspicion of Gregor Stonar to surface.
"But if we don't arrest him, what do we do?" Maguire asked.
"I don't think we can do a great deal inside Taro," Trenair said thoughtfully. "About all that's really available to us, I think, is to encourage Father Franklin to pursue this matter, discreetly, of course. I'll send a message to Bishop Executor Turner instructing him to assist Father Franklin as well. And I think it might be a good idea to transfer a few more agents of Inquisition into Taro from Desnair and Siddermark, Jaspar. Let's get some more eyes and ears into Trangier. If we can find evidence Gorgia's already in contact with the Carizians, I'd be a lot more inclined to try to arrest him, even if the attempt is likely to fail."
"You know," Ducairn said pensively, "I have to wonder, aside from the example of yet another secular ruler deserting Mother Church, how much would losing Taro really hurt us? You haven't actually been counting on the galleons they're building being available in our order of battle, have you, Elaine?"
"Not really," Maguire admitted unhappily. "We went ahead and ordered them, but the chances of Taro's actually getting them completed, manned, and armed, and then getting them to sea past the Carizians are pretty damned slim."
"That's what I was thinking," Ducairn said, and looked at Trenair and Clinton. "As Mother Church's treasurer, I may be more aware than the rest of you of how much money we're putting into Taro, and for how little return. That blockade's been damnably effective, and Taro's paid less than a third of its usual tithe ever since the war began. For that matter, this year the Exchequer doesn't expect Gorgia to be able to pay at all. To be brutally frank, losing the kingdom completely would be barely a bump as far as our finances are concerned. So I think what we really need to think about are the political and military consequences. And as Elaine's just said, losing Taro from our side would have very little impact on our capabilities. So how much would gaining Taro help the other side?"
"An interesting point," Clinton said thoughtfully. "The political damage would be worse, I think, if only as an example of ongoing erosion. Militarily, I doubt Taro would add much to Caleb's military capabilities. In fact, it would give them still more territory to protect, which would spread their forces even thinner."
"By the same token, though," Maguire pointed out, "it would give them a naval base right off the Siddermark coast. It would dominate the Gulf of Taro and close off the Taro Channel, which would pretty much isolate the Gulf of Matthias."
"Drive a wedge between our northern squadrons and Desnair, you mean?" Trenair asked.
"Exactly. But how realistic a concern is that?" Ducairn asked.
I mean, if Rockpoint's already basing his squadron in Thol Bay, then they've already got a naval base right there on the Taro Channel, don't they?
Well, yes, Maguire admitted slowly.
Then the only real difference is that it would become an official naval base, Ducairn pointed out.
So what you're suggesting, Robert, is that we not act precipitously and give Gorja a pretext for deserting us, but continue to investigate cautiously, Trenaire said. If we find proof, real proof, or at least strongly suggestive evidence, we can go ahead and try to arrest him. And if it should happen he either surprises us by actually changing sides, or goes over to Caleb after we give him that pretext, it's not really going to hurt us that much militarily or economically.
More or less, Ducairn shrugged. This is your area of expertise, yours and Jaspar's, where the politics are concerned, and Elaine's where the military's concerned. I'm simply trying to examine this question from all perspectives. It's not, he finished dryly, as if we haven't gotten ourselves into trouble upon occasion by acting too precipitously.
Clinton flushed at the none-too-oblique reference to his own final solution to the Carizian problem. He chose to let it pass, however. At the same time, his eyes took on a thoughtful look. He sat silently pondering for several seconds, then nodded to himself and refocused his eyes on the other three.
I'm not sure keeping our hands off Taro is the right way to proceed. On the other hand, I'm not sure it isn't the right way either. He shrugged. Under the circumstances, I think a wait-and-see attitude's less likely to go catastrophically wrong, though. At the same time, I think we ought to think about ways to disaster-proof our position, as it were, if Taro does switch sides.
What do you have in mind? Trenaire sounded a bit cautious, and Clinton smiled.
I'm not planning on running off in a bout of excessive enthusiasm, Zompson. I was just thinking about what Elaine said about Taro's strategic position, about its offering the Carizians a naval base between our northern squadrons and Desnaire.
And?
And it occurred to me that one way to prevent that from becoming a problem would be to concentrate our forces in the Gulf of Matthias right now, before Taro does whatever it is Gorja's planning to do.
What? Trenaire blinked.
Look, it's already September, Clinton said, and twitched his head in the direction of the council chamber's window.
Icy rain pounded down outside, and nearly leafless branches swayed in the wind.
It won't be long before Xingwu's passage starts to freeze over again. When that happens, our northern squadrons, the ones we've built here in the Temple Lands, and all the ships Ha Chong's built in her northern ports, are going to be stuck. If we get them out now, before the ice closes in, and send all of them to Desnaire, we'll have all 74 Desnarian galleons, and at least 50 or 60 each from Ha Chong and the Temple Lands. That's between 170 and 200 galleons, in one concentrated force, less than 2,000 miles from Taro and barely 3,000 from Karis. If we get them there before Gorja changes sides, it might suggest to him that treason would be a bad idea. And even if they don't get there until after he changes sides, or if he goes ahead and betrays us despite their presence, we'd have a serious force in place both to threaten Taro and Karis and to force them to redeploy against it. After what Thirsk did in the Gulf of Dolar, they'd have to take that threat seriously, don't you think?
Trenaire and Ducairn were both looking at him in surprise now. As a general rule, Clinton didn't much concern himself with military movements. Partly, Ducairn thought cynically, because it had been his breezy confidence where military affairs he'd known nothing about were concerned, which had launched this entire disaster in the first place.
I don't know, Jaspar, Maguire said slowly. The new constructions scattered up and down the length of the passage. We'd have to get it all into one place first, and a good quarter of the ships we've managed to launch and rig still don't have their artillery.
He grimaced.
I'm afraid our foundries have been slower to really hit their stride than we'd anticipated. And frankly, Ha Chong's foundries are nowhere near as efficient as they could be either. They've got a lot of them, but their output's lower even than ours. For that matter, their best ones are in South Ha Chong, in Shui and Kuznetsov. And before Thirsk ran the Carizians out of Claw Island, they put a major hole in the delivery of the guns South Ha Chong had managed to produce.
Well, Desnair's foundries are doing pretty well, aren't they?
Clinton riposted and cocked an eyebrow at Ducairne.
Production numbers are rising, Ducairne acknowledged. It's not that their individual foundries are especially big or especially efficient, but they do have a higher output per furnace than Ha Chong, and they've been establishing a lot of little cannon foundries. They're still having problems with iron guns, though. Everybody is.
Except for Karras, he carefully did not say out loud. But even more of Desnair's iron pieces seem to be failing when they're proofed.
That's just a matter of experience, Clinton said dismissively. Of course they're not going to get it right the first few times they try. But if they've got the foundries, sooner or later they'll be able to produce the guns we need.
Why not send them to Dolar instead? Ducairne suggested.
Maguire and Trenaire looked thoughtful, but Clinton's face turned expressionless as the shutters went up behind his eyes.
Thirsk seems to have straightened out the Dolaran foundries. At least he's been able to compensate for the Ha Chong guns the Carizians took. By now, according to the invoices I'm getting, he's actually far enough ahead of his own demand that he's in a position to export guns to Ha Chong instead of the other way around.
Dolar's too far from Taro and Karras, Clinton said flatly, and Ducairne felt one eyebrow arch.
He glanced at Trenaire and saw the same speculation on the Chancellor's face. Just as Clinton had never truly been prepared to give Gorgia of Taro a clean bill of health over the betrayal of the Group of Four's original plan of attack, he'd never forgiven Thirsk for first losing the Battle of Crag Reach and then surrendering his surviving ships to Caleb Armok. The Dolaran ought to have fought until every one of his galleys went to the bottom, in Clinton's opinion. The fact that he hadn't, that he'd put the lives of his men above his service to Mother Church, made him automatically and permanently suspect to the Grand Inquisitor. Clinton had acquiesced only grudgingly in Thirsk's appointment to his present post, and only when all three other members of the Group of Four had voted against him. And he'd bitterly resented Thirsk's demands that Mother Church pay the wages of his sailors. As far as Clinton was concerned, those sailors should be eager to volunteer in God's own cause. Besides, the church had dozens of other things it could have used that money for. And that didn't even consider Thirsk's ridiculous insistence that the church ought to pay pensions to the survivors of men who were killed in her service. The Grand Inquisitor hadn't been happy when Ducairne supported Thirsk's policies. Having the church's treasurer agree that the outrageous demands were reasonable and manageable had cut the ground out from under his own arguments. Maguire's unusually stubborn insistence that Thirsk had the best grasp of the new naval tactics hadn't made him any more cheerful. And rather than agreeing with Ducairne and Maguire that Thirsk's performance in the Ha Chong Narrows demonstrated that the Earl had been right all along, Clinton sided with the opinion, coming, Ducairne suspected, from Duke Thorast, that Thirsk had simply been lucky. Lucky in the weather, lucky in outnumbering the Carizians by such a huge margin, and, probably, lucky the Carizians had withdrawn from Claw Island before he was finally ready to attack it, since they would undoubtedly have defeated him, again, if he'd actually had to fight to evict them. Only the fact that the Duke of Fern and Bishop Stiphon Mike, Clinton's own intendant for the fleet, strongly supported Thirsk, had held the Grand Inquisitor's ire in check. Well, that and the fact that Thirsk's victory was the only victory any of the church's squadrons had so far achieved. And as far as I can tell, the fact that Thirsk allowed the Carizians to surrender has only pissed him off even more.
Dukern very carefully did not grimace.
As far as Jaspar's concerned, the only good Carizian is a dead one. He sees absolutely no reason Thirsk should have let them surrender. Even Elaine understands that if our admirals don't allow them to surrender, then their admirals won't allow our crews to surrender. I don't think Jaspar really cares about that, though. In fact, I wonder if he wouldn't actually prefer a situation in which the other side flatly refused to give quarter. He probably sees it as the best way to motivate our people to fight to the bitter end, exactly the way Thirsk didn't do at Crag Reach.
I admit Dolar's a long way from Karis and Taro, the treasurer said. On the other hand, as Elaine says, our ships are scattered all over the passage, and nothing the Carizians have is close enough to threaten the passage.
We could send them all away to Gorath Bay without having to worry about their being intercepted. And Dolar's much closer to Chisholm, and Coruscant for that matter, going west.
Of course it is.
Clinton waved an impatient hand dismissively.
And the Carizians who evacuated Claw Island went straight to Chisholm to reinforce the ships they already had there. In fact, that's another reason to send our ships to Desnair.
Dukern looked at him quizzically, and he snorted.
They've had to disperse strength to cover Chisholm and Coruscant, Robert.
Clinton was back to that adult lecturing a particularly slow child tone of his, but Dukern was too accustomed to it to rise to the baiting. For that matter, he wasn't even certain Clinton was still doing it on purpose.
Our best estimate is that Rock Point has about 20 or 25 galleons based on Thole Bay, and Lock Island has another 35 or 40 operating out of Rockshoal Bay. That's 65 total. The rest of their galleons are dispersed, protecting Chisholm and Coruscant. What I'm proposing is that we take advantage of that dispersal to punch our ships through to Desnair. By the time they can redeploy the ships they have on distant stations, we'll be concentrated in the Gulf of Matthias, and there won't be anything they can do about it.
Trenair was looking thoughtful, and even Dukern had to admit there was a certain logic to Clinton's argument. Still, the thing which had most impressed Dukern about the failure of their initial attack on Karis was that sending fleets on lengthy voyages with coordinated timetables, which didn't consider little things like, weather, seemed to be significantly more problematical than sending armies on lengthy marches.
You're talking about sending 100 to 220 of our galleons past Taro to Desnair, he said now. According to Elaine, a quarter of them would be completely unarmed. So, say we have your highest number available for the trip, 120. That means only 90 of them would actually be armed, and none of our ships are as well trained as Earl Thirsk's were. If the 60 or 70 Carizians manage to intercept them, I don't know how well our 90 would make out, Jaspar. I don't like saying that any more than you like hearing it, he added as Clinton's face tightened. But we have to be realistic. And it's not their fault, either. They simply haven't had the time to train.
Robert has a point, Trenair said in a reasonable tone. Yes,
Magwer said slowly. The others all looked at him, and he held up his right hand, index finger extended.
Yes, he repeated, but we've got the semaphore.
And Dukern prompted when the Captain General paused again.
First, Magwer said, we ought to have the advantage of surprise when we actually start moving the ships. Distance alone ought to see to that, but let's assume the Carizian spies here in the Temple Lands have access to the commercial messages we allow the semaphore to pass. Or, for that matter, just that they have a network of homing wyverns to carry messages, whatever. It's obvious they do have spies somewhere in the system, right?
Dukern nodded, impressed despite himself. thinking things through wasn't something he normally associated with Elaine Maguire.
All right. In that case, we openly send orders to our squadrons all along Sing Wu's passage. For that matter, let's send them in one of the ciphers we're pretty sure the Carizians may have compromised in Delphirak or Coruscant. We order them to rendezvous at Angelberg, but we tell them that's a ruse. They're concentrating there to help any Carizian spies. Assume we're going to send them to Desnair, but they're to prepare to sail to Dolar. Even if the message isn't compromised along the semaphore chain, you know at least some of their crew will talk about their upcoming trip to Dolar whenever they get a chance to go ashore in Angelberg. So any Carizian spies are going to hear about that destination, and as far as preparing for the voyage is concerned, it doesn't matter whether they're going to Dolar or Desnair, really.
His eyes were beginning to sparkle now as his enthusiasm mounted.
So, our cover story is that their preparations are to take them west. Any spies who spot them in Chantry Bay will almost certainly find out about their orders to Dolar, and we don't tell even our admirals differently until they're all ready to sail. At that point, we use the semaphore to send them their actual sailing orders. Surely that ought to ensure that we have strategic surprise. In fact, if the Carizians do get wind of their original orders, they may shift their own deployments to protect Chisholm and Coruscant. Then, once we have our ships in motion to the east instead of the west, we use the semaphore to order the Desnarians to sortie to meet them. We'll be able to tell Desnair to sail more quickly than the Carizians will be able to tell their squadrons to concentrate. So, ideally, Lock Island will still be lying to anchor in Rockshoal Bay when Rock Point and his 25 ships find themselves caught between 70-odd Desnarian galleons coming up from the south and 100 to 120 Harchongese and Temple Lands galleons coming down from the north.
That's a very good thought, Elaine, Clinton congratulated. And there's another aspect to it as well. We can keep track of both forces as long as they stay in coastal waters. So, if one of them hits a snag, or if it turns out the Carizians have somehow managed to concentrate against one of them, we can order the other one to turn around and avoid action.
Maguire beamed, clearly basking in the unaccustomed light of the Grand Inquisitor's approval. Even Trenair was nodding, slowly at first, but then more firmly. Ducairn, on the other hand, still had profound reservations. Maguire's and Clinton's ideas about coordinating two separate fleets sounded good in theory, but he couldn't quite convince himself it would work out that smoothly in practice. On the other hand, Maguire did have a point about achieving surprise. If no one outside the group of four itself knew where the northern ships were really going to go, no one could possibly betray that information to Karras. And it really didn't matter how quickly the information got to Karras once the ships actually began moving, because Carizian warships as far away as Chisholm or Coruscant would be so badly out of position that they might as well have been on the bottom of the sea. They couldn't possibly reach the Gulf of Taro or the Sea of Justice before the Church's fleets had either united with one another or turned around and returned separately to their original ports. He watched the other three and realized that whatever qualms he might feel, all of them were in favor. That being the case, he wasn't going to prevent it, whatever he did. So he wouldn't try. He would content himself with voicing his own reservations mild enough he could brush them away later with a smile for his own timidity, if they proved unfounded, but sufficiently pointed to position him, if things turned out badly after all, to remind them all that he'd warned them against overconfidence. He sat back in his chair, waiting while Maguire and Clinton worked out the details to their own satisfaction. There'd been a time when Robert Ducairn hadn't worried all that much about political calculations. He'd risen to his post as treasurer mostly because he'd been the consummate bureaucrat, content to leave politics, mother churches, and secular politics alike to Trenaire and Clinton.
And the fact that we're having this discussion is proof of how well that worked out, isn't it, Robert?
He asked himself acidly.
On the other hand, even you can learn if God hits you with a heavy enough club. The real trick's going to be convincing them, and especially Jaspar, that you still don't have a clue.
He smiled inwardly, behind an expression that mingled patience with just a touch of boredom. It was ironic, he thought, that his bargain with Clinton should do so much to convince the Grand Inquisitor to completely disregard any threat he might represent. That the man who was supposed to be the keeper of Mother Church's conscience regarded Duquesne's insistence on actually discharging his responsibilities as one of God's vicars as proof of maudlin, foggy-mindedness.
You just go right on seeing things that way, Jaspar,
Robert Duquesne thought coldly,
because one of these days you're going to find out just how wrong you truly are.
5. HMS Royal Carus 58, City of Telesburg, Kingdom of Old Carus.
I was wondering when they'd get around to this, Caleb Armok said sourly. He, Charlian, their daughter, and one Captain Merlin Athrawis were afloat once more. Empress of Carus was still in yard hands, so he and Charlian flew their standard aboard HMS Royal Carus, one of the new 58-gun galleons designed to avoid Empress of Carus's problems. They wouldn't actually be leaving Telesburg for their return to Chisholm until the morning tide, but they'd decided to get Princess Alana aboard ship and settled that afternoon. Of course, that also meant they had to be a bit more careful about keeping their voices down, given the thinness of cabin bulkheads.
Well, Brian Locke Island said rather more philosophically from his own flagship, we figured they'd have to decide what to do with all those ships before Singwu's passage froze. Now we know. I have to admit, though, I didn't expect them to be quite this subtle. Gather their fleet in a western port, then send them all west?
He shook his head.
That's a lot sneakier than I anticipated, frankly.
Locke Island had a point, Merlin conceded. The port of Angelburg on Chantry Bay lay on the southern shore of Singwu's passage, almost 3,000 miles east of Temple Bay. It was nearly halfway to the eastern mouth of the passage, where it debouched into the Icewind Sea, and well over 7,000 miles from the passage's western mouth. Had it not been for the orders to the various squadron commanders, he would have assumed they were planning on coming east instead of west. Fortunately, they had been able to read those orders, which confirmed that what they were really planning was what Merlin and Locke Island had both considered to be their smartest move all along.
They are being clever, aren't they?
Prince Narmon remarked from Erastor, where his own galleon was waiting to join Royal Carus for the voyage to Chisholm.
Maybe so, but now that we've caught them at it, the problem's deciding what to do about it,
Dominic Stainer put in from Thole Bay over his own comm.
No, Caleb said, his tone ever more sour than it had been. It isn't deciding what we do about it. It's deciding how we go about doing it. We're all agreed that this is the most logical thing for them to be doing after what happened to Gwilym. And I think we have to honor the threat, which means reinforcing both Coruscant and Chisholm.
I'm afraid you're right, Merlin sighed.
So am I, Locke Island conceded. But while we're worrying about what Thirsk might do, let's not forget about Coleman and Jarrus.
Merlin grimaced. The fact that he dared not insert remotes into the temple itself always left a blank area at the very apex of their intelligence analyses. There was simply no way to get eyes and ears inside the innermost councils of the group of four, and their ignorance of what went on there was all the more frustrating because of their ability to penetrate every other council of war on the planet.
He kept reminding himself that he and his allies had better intelligence on their enemies' plans and capabilities than anyone else in the history of mankind. The problem was that they needed that kind of advantage if they were ever going to prevail against someone so numerically superior to themselves. And they'd been waiting for 5 days to find out which way the church's new navy was going to jump as autumn came on. As Lock Island had pointed out, they'd known Alain Maguire and his colleagues would have to choose a course of action before the northern ports started to freeze. Of course, they could have decided to just sit there, but no one had really expected that. After the declaration of holy war and the bloody fashion in which Clintan had secured the Group of Four's rear in the Temple and Zion, it had seemed a foregone conclusion that they weren't going to simply leave 100 or so brand new galleons frozen into the ice for several months. As Merlin, Caleb, Lock Island, and Rock Point had considered the church's options, they'd concluded that there were three possible ice-free destinations: Shui Bay, Garath Bay, and the Gulf of Matthias. There were arguments in favor of all three. For that matter, there'd been a fourth possibility, Bedard Bay, in the Republic of Sidermark. North Bedard Bay would actually have been the most defensible of all the ice-free ports available, and given Clinton's near-psychotic suspicion of all things Sidermarkian, basing a sizable contingent of the church's new fleet right off the capital city's waterfront as a suggestion that the Lord Protector should behave himself could have been tempting. There was also the question of just how the church might choose to split up the ships it was moving south. In fact, Merlin had rather hoped they'd parcel the northern units out between several possible destinations, instead of keeping them concentrated. Having the opposing navy scattered around in as many separate subfleets as possible struck him as a very good idea from Karras's viewpoint. But whatever he might have hoped, Merlin had always expected the church to end up choosing the strategy it had now selected. Given the Earl of Thirsk's accomplishments, combining as much as possible of the church's total naval strength under his command made a lot of sense. Not only that, but under Thirsk's energetic management, Doloran foundries were now churning out more and better guns than anyone else outside of Karras. They were mostly still casting in bronze while they tried to get a handle on the greater difficulties involved in producing reliable iron guns, but their output had risen steadily. And if they were much less innovative than Carizian foundry operators, they were enormously more innovative than the Harchongese. The Harchong economy still ran on what was essentially slave labor. The empire had long established labor-intensive ways of doing things, and its innately reactionary conservatism and ultra-orthodox adherence to the proscriptions of Zhuozheng left it strongly disinclined to make changes. Its sheer size and population had allowed its economy to dominate Western Howard and Haven for the last century and a half, despite its inherent inefficiency, however. And when the church began its massive armament programs, the number of Harchongese foundries had suggested the empire would provide at least a third, and more probably half, of all the required artillery. In fact, however, those plans had capsized when all those small foundries turned out to be so much less productive than expected. Against that sort of backdrop, the way in which Thirsk and Duke Fern had managed to improve the output of Doloran guns was one of the genuine bright spots for the church. And given how badly cannon production continued to lag in both Harchong and the Temple lands, it made a lot of sense to sail as many as possible of the church's still unarmed galleons to Garath Bay. With Claw Island now firmly in Thirsk's hands, the voyage would be both shorter and far more secure than trying to send them to any other destination. It would also just happen to put the better part of 200 galleons under the church's best admiral in an ideal position to strike at Chisholm or Coruscant from the east,
and since the Imperial Carizian Navy had only about 97 galleons of its own after Sir Gwilym Manthir's losses in the Harchong Narrows, redeploying to meet that threat was going to be difficult. Especially since, as Brian's just been kind enough to point out, we still have to worry about the frigging Desnarians, too, Merlin thought disgustedly. Duke Coleman and Admiral Jarrus reminded Merlin rather forcibly of an old Terran general named McClellan. They were pretty fair managers, all things considered. Despite ongoing problems with their own artillery production, they'd managed to get around 70 galleons launched, armed, and more or less manned. It was a significant accomplishment, particularly given the fact that there'd been no real Desnarian shipbuilding industry before the church's massive program. Of course, there'd been an enormous amount of graft. Some of the ships weren't all that well built, and Desnarian guns had a tendency to blow up more often than most, but 70-plus galleons were still 70-plus galleons. The good news, and the main reason Coleman and Jarrus made Merlin think about McClellan, was that, having built their navy, they were disinclined to have anything unfortunate happen to it. What Duncan Yearley and HMS Destiny had done to Commodore Wellar clearly loomed large in their thinking, and especially in Baron Jarrus's. In fact, he'd refused to venture outside of the Gulf of Jarrus' sheltered waters to train his crews, which suited Karis just fine. But if they redeployed enough strength to protect Chisholm and Coruscant against an admiral as capable as Thirsk, even Jarrus might find it within himself to operate with a modicum of aggressiveness. And if that happened... "We're going to have to make some deep cuts in home waters, Brian, no matter what the Desnarians may be thinking about doing," Caleb said finally. "Thirsk is just too damn good. If he comes at Chisholm with 200 galleons, we need a lot more than Sharpfield has in the area now to stop him." Lock Island nodded heavily. Sir Luke Coleman, the Earl of Sharpfield, had been the commanding officer of the Royal Chisholmian Navy. As such, he was now the second-ranking officer after Lock Island himself in the Imperial Carizian Navy. That rank, plus his intimate familiarity with Chisholmian waters, made him the logical, indeed the only, choice to command the squadrons protecting Charlian's kingdom. As a peacetime officer, he'd been outstanding, especially with his determination to root out corruption at all levels, and no one doubted his personal courage. Yet all his combat experience was with galleys. He'd never commanded even a single galleon in action. Now he was in command of an entire fleet of them, and the thought of giving him his first experience with it outnumbered 6 or 7 to 1 wasn't particularly appealing. "It would help if we had someone in Chisholm or Coruscant with a comm," Charlian pointed out. "If Sir Luke or Admiral Mondeer had access to the Snarks, they could combine their strength into a single force that would have a far better chance of matching Thirsk." It was Merlin's turn to nod. Garth Ralston, the Earl of Mondeer, had been Sharpfield's Emeraldian equivalent. He was younger than Sharpfield, without as many years of experience at sea, but he'd proven he was a fighter at Darkos Sound, and years of service under Prince Narmon had given him a degree of political acumen which the bluff, apolitical Sharpfield completely lacked. That was why he'd been chosen to command squadrons covering Coruscant.
"Unfortunately, the only flag officer we could send would be you, Dominic," Lock Island said.
Which, Caleb interrupted in a slightly odd, almost amused tone, "would be politically awkward at this particular moment."
"Awkward but survivable, Your Majesty," Rockpoint said respectfully. "I know Gorja wants me right where I am when we finally have him announce he's coming over, but I can think of a half dozen other officers who could hold down this command as well as I can. Cody Niles comes to mind, among others."
"I'm sure Admiral Niles could handle your naval duties perfectly adequately, my lord," Narmon put in, The problem is that all Gorge's calculations are built around having you covering Thol Bay to make sure no nasty Desnarians come sailing in to attack him when the Church finds out he's changing sides. He's nervous enough already, and I don't think he shares our Navy's contempt for Jarrus. Which, given how much closer he is to Desnair than we are, probably isn't all that unreasonable when you come down to it. It's obvious he's developed enough faith in you to feel confident, but if we reorganize everything on the fly, I think there's at least a fair chance he'll back off at the last moment.
Especially if he should happen to become aware of the fact that the Inquisition's sending more investigators into Taro, Merlin agreed. I think Merlin and Narman have a point, Caleb, Charlian said unhappily.
So do I, Caleb agreed,
but the amusement in his tone was even more pronounced. And then he shook his head, mock regretfully, at his wife and surprised all of them with a laugh. Did I miss something humorous? Charlian asked a bit tartly, and he nodded, still chuckling.
As a matter of fact, you did, he said. Came as a bit of a shock to me, too, since you're not usually so slow.
Slow? She repeated even more tartly. Indeed, one might have described her own tone as ominous.
Well, you do seem to have overlooked the minor fact that we're both going to be in Chisholm, and so is a fellow named Merlin, unless I'm mistaken.
Charlian's eyes widened. For a moment, she sat staring at him, with the expression of a very smart woman who very seldom made foolish mistakes. Then it was her turn to laugh.
Of course we are. And if memory serves, you've had a modicum of naval combat experience yourself, haven't you?
A modicum, her husband agreed, holding up his thumb and index finger about an inch apart.
With all due respect, Your Majesty, I'm not in favor of risking you at sea, Lock Island said.
Caleb arched an eyebrow, and the High Admiral shrugged.
At Armageddon Reef and Darkle Sound, your father was right about how important it was for the fleet to know you were there. I don't think this situation's exactly comparable, though, and there are all sorts of reasons why having you killed would be politically disastrous.
It was obvious from Lock Island's voice that he had some highly personal reasons for not wanting to see his cousin killed as well. And Caleb's eyes softened, but then he shook his head. First, we have a firmly secured succession now, he said, reaching out and taking Charlian's hand in his own. There's not a single soul in Old Cardis who wouldn't accept Charlie as Empress in her sole right if something happened to me. And there's also Alana now. So the arguments about how utterly indispensable I am seem just a bit less compelling than they used to be. Second, with all due modesty, the Navy has a certain degree of confidence in me. I think they'll probably find it reassuring to have me with them if they've got to go into battle at such unfavorable odds.
Saying the Imperial Carizian Navy had a certain degree of confidence in Caleb Armok was rather like saying there was a certain amount of water in the Great Western Ocean, Merlin reflected.
But third, and most important of all, I'm the only person we've got, aside from you, Brian, we could possibly send to Chisholm who has both access to Al Snark's and enough seniority to give Sharpfield orders. There's no way in the world we could justify leaving me ashore for this one, and you know it.
He's right, Brian, Charlian said quietly and grimaced. I'm pretty sure I'm even unhappier than you are at the notion of letting him go and get shot at again. Her hand tightened on Caleb's. But he's still right.
There was silence for a moment while the Emperor sat, fingers of his free hand drumming lightly on a side table while he thought. Then he inhaled deeply. All right, he said. That's what we're going to do. And I'm going to have to take more of your fleet strength than I'd like to, Brian. We can't not reinforce Chisholm and Coruscant strongly when we know what's coming at them, and we can't wait. This time of year, it's going to take longer for us to get reinforcements to Chisholm than it'll take Magwer's new construction to get to Gorath Bay. I know we'll have a little bit of time in hand, at least, after they get there, but I don't want to give Thirsk a gift of any more time than we have to. On the other hand, we can't organize all of this in a flash. It's going to take at least a few days, and I don't want to delay our own departure for Chisholm. I think I agree with Merlin and Narmon that we need to leave Dominic where he is, and with me there, we'll have Snark access without him. So, we'll send the reinforcements out after Royal Caris under Admiral Niles. He's a good man, and I can use him.
Yes, Your Majesty, Lock Island said formally, half bowing to his distant emperor. How much strength do you want me to send with him?
That's what really scares me, Caleb said frankly. I don't see how we could possibly cover both Chisholm and Coruscant with less than 60 sail.
The silence which greeted that number was profound, and Caleb's lips twitched.
I can eke that out with the best of the old carronade-armed galleys, he continued, but even with the Snarks, I can't magically reproduce galleons like rabbits. I'll be able to see what Thirsk is up to, but if he fights as smart as we all expect him to, he's not going to split up into smaller forces I can pick off one at a time. He's going to come at me with everything he's got in one concentrated fleet, and I'm going to need enough firepower to stop him when he does. Which, even with 60 galleons, is going to be a tall order, now that he knows exactly what broadside fire can do. That's where hopefully the Snarks will come in by letting me choose the tactical situation when we finally engage.
Your Majesty, Rockpoint said after a moment, I can't dispute anything you've just said, but if we deploy 60 sail to Chisholm and Coruscant, that's only going to leave about 30 to keep an eye on waters closer to Old Caris.
I know, Caleb said, but even with 60, we'll still be outnumbered in Chisholmian waters by better than 3-1. And frankly, if I'm going to be outnumbered 3-1 up against someone as good as Thirsk, then I think we have to be willing to take a chance on people as good as you and Brian being outnumbered 2-1 against a second-rater like Jarrus.
Rockpoint said nothing for a moment, then nodded.
At the same time, though, I'm not repeating the mistake we made with Gwillem, Caleb said, his brown eyes hardening. We've got a lot more schooners than we need for blockade duty, especially now that Taro's joining the Empire. So I want at least 15 or 20 of them sent out with Niles. That ought to give me plenty of fast cruisers to picket Claw Island and the Harchong Narrows closely, which hopefully will explain how I'm managing to keep an eye on Thirsk, with enough more left over for effective hit-and-run raids in the Gulf to generally make his life as miserable as possible. I don't think we're likely to panic him into a misstep just by throwing commerce raiders at him, but I'm certainly willing to try. And it's not as if Thirsk is operating in a political vacuum, he continued. Even with Mike in his corner, Thoras still doing his best to stab him in the back. If I can raise enough havoc in the Gulf of Dolar and the same waters where Gwillem was operating, I may be able to give Thoras a hand. Caleb grimaced. Part of me hates doing that to an honorable man, but he's just too damned capable. I'll settle for getting him out of the way any way I can, I'm afraid.
Actually, I think that's a very good idea, Lock Island said. If we hit them with an offensive of our own, we may preempt their plans, and I'll probably be able to send you even more schooners over the next couple of months.
That, Merlin reflected, was true enough. Not only was the Navy's requirement for blockade vessels going to decline, as Caleb had just pointed out, but privateering was nowhere near as profitable as it once had been. By now, most of the church's merchant shipping was traveling in convoys, which were increasingly protected by ships, with enough artillery to make any attack upon them a chancy proposition. More to the point, though, there simply wasn't very much enemy merchant shipping left, which meant dozens of fast, agile, heavily armed schooners were being disposed of by privateering consortiums who no longer needed them. In fact, they were glutting the market so badly they could be picked up for the proverbial song.
Good thinking, Caleb agreed. And as for the situation in Carisian and Taroisian waters, Dominic, don't forget, Edward's making progress with Alfred Shells now. He ought to be starting production in another month or so.
Starting production, Rock Point repeated dryly.
Edward Hausman was as frustrated as anyone had ever seen him over the delays in putting Seamount Shells into production. Not that it was his fault. Not even his access to OWL could magically produce the equipment, the techniques, and, above all, the trained workforce he needed overnight. Especially since he was rather in the position Merlin had always been in. He could make suggestions, even have an occasional flash of brilliance, but to avoid charges of violating the prescriptions, he had to be able to demonstrate a development process, and, given the declaration of holy war, that was more important than ever. By now, he'd managed that, but he'd been deeply frustrated by how long it had taken. And once he'd managed that part, it had been only to run into almost intolerable weather delays in getting his new shell-producing manufactory up and running. Torrential rains, which went on seemingly forever. Weather-spawned avalanches, which imposed blockages on the canal system serving his ironworks. And then no less than 3 tropical storms blowing in off the Sea of Justice in a single 2-month period. If he hadn't known the truth about the archangels, the industrialist would have been inclined to think God really was on the other side. But at least he finally had the foundations in, a roof on, and the furnaces under construction. Even so, it was going to be at least another 2 or 3 months, possibly even into March, before he was able to provide the new projectiles to the Navy in anything like adequate numbers.
"I know we're not going to be able to start issuing them until spring," Lock Island said now. "On the other hand, they're sending the vast bulk of their naval strength to Thirsk. Even if he decides to try a galleon-equipped version of the original Armageddon Reef plan, we'll have something like 6 or 7 months before he could possibly get to Old Cardis. Frankly, I don't think there's a chance in hell they'll try that again, though. Not after what happened last time, and not when Chisholm and Coruscant are so much closer to Gorath Bay. So the important thing is to get His Majesty reinforced heavily enough to deter Thirsk until Edward does have enough shells for us. Once that happens," the High Admiral smiled nastily, "we'll be the ones going looking for them, and they won't like it a bit when a shell-armed battle line catches up with them either."
October, Year of God, 894. 1. HMS Royal Carus, 58, Zebediah C. HMS Armagh, 58, Carus C. And HMS Destroyer, 54, Thole Bay.
Shit.
Merlin Athrawas pronounced the single word with a quiet, terrible emphasis as he gazed at the latest download from OWL. Royal Carus was crossing the Zebediah Sea, 6 5-days out of Telesburg, and almost exactly halfway to Cherraith. It was just after Langhorne's watch, the Safeholdian midnight, and Caleb and Charlian were sound asleep.
"Waking them up won't help a damned thing," Merlin thought grimly. "On the other hand, if I don't wake them up and tell them about this, they're both going to be pissed as hell."
He considered the time, then grimaced as he decided on a compromise. Crown Princess Alana would be waking up to demand her early feeding in no more than another hour. He could let the Emperor and Empress have at least that much more sleep. On the other hand, it was 4 hours earlier in Telesburg, so... Brian Lock Island's eyes narrowed as the invisible plug in his right ear chirped at him. Then began a soft rendition of a peculiar piece of music. The sound, the opening bars of something which had once been called Anchors Away, sounded very strange to any Safeholdian. It also identified the caller as Merlin Athrawas, however, and Lock Island hadn't expected to hear from him for at least another couple of hours.
For that matter, Merlin always tried to avoid calling when anyone who wasn't already part of the inner circle was present. Which suggested the High Admiral had better take this particular call.
All right, Henry, he said to the Lieutenant Commander sitting across the table from him. I think that covers just about everything. There are a couple of other points I'd like to discuss before the meeting tomorrow, but let me mull them over tonight.
Of course, sir. Henry Tillier had been Lock Island's flag lieutenant for over 3 years. Since his promotion to lieutenant commander, Lock Island had decided to emulate Earl Thirsk and turned Tillier into his chief of staff. Unlike Thirsk, however, who was inventing the concept on his own, Lock Island had benefited from researching the historical development and organization of staff officers in OWL's databanks. As a result, he was well along the way to creating a genuine staff with specific designated areas of responsibility, and he was already making mental selections for the flag officers, Navy, Army, and Marine, he intended to nominate to Caleb when the Emperor inaugurated the concept of a general staff for the entire Empire in another few months. At the moment, it was obvious Tillier, who knew him far better than most, was more than a little perplexed by the High Admiral's abrupt termination of their meeting. But whatever questions might be running through his brain, he wasn't about to ask them. Instead, he gathered up the notes he'd been taking, jogged them together, and slid them into a folder. Then he smiled at Lock Island, finished the last swallow in his whiskey glass, and cuffed Lock Island's Rottweiler, Keelhaul, gently and affectionately on his massive head. Keelhaul chuffed in acknowledgement of the goodbye, without ever opening his eyes, and Tillier chuckled.
"I'll see you in the morning, sir."
"By all means. In fact, join me for breakfast, if you would."
"Of course, sir."
Tillier nodded respectfully and withdrew, shutting the door behind him. Lock Island looked at the closed door for a moment, then stood and opened the many-paned glass door to HMS Armok's sternwalk. He leaned on the rail, gazing up at a sky that was fading from blue into indigo. A few of the brightest stars were visible, but it would be a while before darkness actually fell.
"Yes, Merlin," he said then, quietly, his voice inaudible through the sound of wind and water to anyone more than 2 or 3 feet away from him.
"I'm sorry to disturb you," Merlin's voice said in his earplug, and Lock Island felt his eyebrows knitting in quick alarm as the Sajan's grim tone registered. "Unfortunately," Merlin continued, "we've got a problem. A big one."
"What do you mean?" Lock Island asked quickly, and heard a distant sigh.
"We've been had," Merlin said flatly. "They aren't sending the fleet to Thirsk after all. They're sending it to Desnare."
2 hours later, Merlin, Caleb, and Charlian sat on Royal Caris's sternwalk.
"It's my fault," Merlin said.
"Oh, crack and shit," Caleb snapped. "Just how the hell is this supposed to be your fault? Or at least all your fault, which seems to be where you're headed?"
"They're my snarks, and I was the one who was so sure they'd be sending everything to Thirsk," Merlin replied. "If I hadn't predisposed everyone to think..."
"Caleb's right, Merlin. That is crack and shit."
Lock Island sounded even more impatient than the Emperor had.
"You weren't the only one who thought Gorath Bay was the logical destination. And whatever you may have thought, we had confirmation, written confirmation, official orders, mind you, that all of us had examined through OWL's snarks. At which point, all of us concluded the ships were going where they'd been ordered to go by none other than Elaine Maguire. So just how were you supposed to realize they'd decide to go somewhere else at the last minute?"
"I don't think they did decide at the last minute," Narman Bates said.
Like Caleb and Charlian, he was returning to Chisholm, but he and his wife were aboard HMS Erastor, one of the 2 galleons escorting Royal Caris.
"I think this is what they intended to do all along."
Then why tell their own captains they were going west? Dominic Stainer asked from his own flagship in Thol Bay.
Disinformation, Narman said simply. Whatever we think of the group before, they really aren't drooling idiots. Fools, perhaps. And arrogant and corrupt, and any other pejorative anyone would care to add, certainly. But I think sometimes we forget that a lot of their mistakes are the result of the fact that they don't have a clue what they're really up against. They still think the old rules apply to things like spying, communication times, and everything else. That's the reason they persistently assumed their semaphore means their communications, what people used to call the communications loop, must be faster than anyone else's when they're actually slower, for some of us at least. My point is that we've been guilty of underestimating them. We know they turned Taro upside down, trying to figure out how their plans leaked before Armageddon Reef. We also know they never found an answer, since Taro didn't actually have anything to do with it. But what should have occurred to us when we were analyzing their cover plan is that eventually they were going to have to assume we have some fiendishly effective spy network in place.
Obviously, that's exactly what they did. As the fact that they were bothering with a cover plan at all should damn well have told someone as clever as I'm supposed to be.
The portly little prince sounded about as bitter as Merlin had ever heard him, and his self-anger was painfully apparent when he paused for a deep breath.
As I say, we should have realized they were going to think of something like this, he went on in a more controlled tone. And given all the coded messages, all of them had passed through the semaphore at one time or another. They have to be aware someone else could be sending coded messages under the guise of simple commercial transactions or personal letters. The only way they could stop that would be to shut down all secular use of the semaphore, and that would cause all sorts of dislocations, not to mention costing them a hefty chunk of their revenue. Not only that, but once they start thinking in that direction, it's going to occur to them that there could be other ways to cobble up an alternative communication system, even if they did shut down the semaphore stations, like carrier wyverns.
He paused again, and Caleb snorted. Back when Prince Narman of Emerald had been conspiring to assassinate King Harald and Crown Prince Caleb of Karras, his chief agent in Telesburg had been one of the kingdom's most prestigious providers of hunting and homing wyverns, which had just happened to provide Narman with a swift, clandestine means of communication between Karras and Emerald.
If they've decided we do have spies in the Temple Lands, and if they've accepted that those spies can get information to us as quickly, or even just almost as quickly, as they can send messages using the semaphore, then it was only a matter of time before they started taking precautions. That's what happened here. They told their captains to prepare to sail west, expecting any of our spies who intercepted those orders to send them along to us, while all the time they were planning on changing their captain's orders at the last minute.
I think Prince Narman's right, Your Majesties,
Rajir Maklan offered from his apartment in Telesburg Palace.
It makes sense, anyway.
Maybe it does, Merlin acknowledged, and maybe that will make me feel better about the way they snookered us someday. It doesn't help much when it comes to deciding what to do about it, though.
No, you've got a point there, Caleb agreed in a much grimmer tone. Frankly, there's not much we can do, Lock Island said bleakly. Cody Niles and your reinforcements are barely a 5-day behind you and Charlion, and the prevailing winds are out of the west. Even if we could communicate with him instantly and explain how the hell we'd done it, he'd still need at least a month, more probably 7 or 8 5-days to get back here.
Thanks to my eagerness to get him started early, you mean, Caleb said.
If you don't want Merlin kicking himself over things that aren't his fault, don't kick yourself over things that aren't your fault, his cousin told him tartly. Given what all of us knew, you made the right decision. They just, as Merlin said, snookered us.
The High Admiral chuckled harshly.
Assuming snookered means what I think it means.
Well, assuming the orders they've sent to Coleman and Jarrus aren't more of Narman's disinformation, they're obviously planning on catching you and Dominic between two forces, Charlian said. So I'd say the first priority is to make sure they don't do that.
I could agree with that, Lock Island said feelingly.
Of course, there is the little problem of how 27 of our galleons fight 130 of theirs, even assuming we can engage them without Jarrus hitting us from behind, Rockpoint pointed out.
Only 90 of them are armed, Lock Island replied, and Rockpoint snorted.
All right, how do 27 of our galleons fight 90 of theirs? I'm willing to count one of ours as worth two of theirs, maybe even 2.5. Hell, let's make it 3. But even assuming we turn the northern force back, we're going to be hurt, Brian, and you know it. So what happens if we get whittled down against one force, then get jumped by the other one? We get hurt badly, Lock Island said grimly. And we see to it that they get hurt a hell of a lot worse.
They don't have a few hundred transports loaded with troops sailing along with them, Charlian pointed out. Even if they manage to get through to Desnair, they don't have an army ready to land anywhere.
You're thinking we could avoid action? Play for time, Caleb said.
More or less, she agreed. All they can really do is sail around. They certainly can't invade Old Karras or Emerald, not against the garrisons we've got in place with rifles and the new artillery.
The problem is that we can't afford to let these two forces unite, Caleb replied. They'd have over 200 galleons in the Gulf of Matthias, and if they could bring Thirsk and his Dolorans down around Howard, they'd have 300. He shook his head. We have to keep them from concentrating. And let's not forget Taro.
Rockpoint's tone was bleak.
You're probably right that they don't have the troop strength for a serious landing in Old Karras or Emerald, Your Majesty. Unfortunately, I'm sure they do have enough strength to carry out raids at least as destructive as the ones we carried out in Coruscant. And whether they can do that or not, between the seamen and the soldiers they've got aboard all those ships, they've got more than enough strength to invade Taro. Gorja doesn't have any of the new weapons, and while I don't think there are as many Taroisian temple loyalists as the group before thinks there are, there are enough to create a genuine civil war if they think the church is invading. If Clintan and Trenair get a couple of hundred galleons into Thol Bay, Taro's gone.
Wonderful, Caleb sighed.
What are your latest numbers on shell production, Edward?
Lock Island asked.
About what they were when you asked me yesterday,
Edward Hausman replied from his bedroom. His normally affable voice was considerably more tart than usual.
Effectively zero, in other words.
We're still setting up the production line, Brian. You know that, and...
I'm not criticizing, Lock Island said quickly. But with only 20 galleons, we're going to need an edge if we're going to stop these bastards.
Well, I'm not going to have the new lineup for at least another 2 5-days.
It was obvious from Hausman's tone that he was kicking himself for not having gotten it up sooner, although, given the weather problems he'd faced.
Well, you've got at least 8 5-days before they can reach the Gulf of Taro, Rockpoint replied. That's almost a month and a half, Edward.
Yes, it is.
Hausman's tone was suddenly far more thoughtful. There was silence for several seconds, then he shrugged.
I can go ahead and start making fuses now, he said. Once I have the furnaces in and the molds ready to go, I can probably produce about 100 or 150 30-pounder shells a day. I might be able to edge that up a little higher if I forget finishing the insides of the shell chambers. In another couple of 5 days, I can probably get 2 more furnaces online, and that will get me up to somewhere around 300 shells a day.
So, figure everything works perfectly from this point, which it damned well hasn't so far, and I can produce, say, 125 shells a day for 2 5-days, and then 300 a day for another 6 5-days. Call it a total of 10,000.
That sounded like an awful lot, Merlin reflected, but it wasn't really, given the normal ammunition allotments of ICN galleons. The establishment was 40 rounds of round shot, 10 rounds of grape shot, and 5 rounds of chain shot per gun. That was almost 3,000 rounds for a single 54-gun galleon. Replacing just the round shot in her shot lockers on a one-for-one basis would require the next best thing to 2,200 shells. On the other hand, if the other side didn't anticipate yet another new Carizian weapon, they might well break and run the moment they encountered it.
And they might not, too, he reminded himself grimly. This isn't going to be like Armageddon Reef or Darko Sound. These ships are coming directly from Harchang and the Temple Lands themselves, and Mother Church has proclaimed holy war. Then there's the little fact that we've already been denounced as Shan Wei worshippers and demon worshippers by Clinton's propaganda. If we start firing exploding shells at them, that's only going to confirm Clinton's lies, at least in the short term. And the fact that they're headed down this way on a jihad against the powers of darkness may actually help them take it in stride.
Not good enough, I'm afraid, Caleb said. Merlin and Charlian looked at him, and he shrugged. Edward's estimate is the number of shells he can deliver 8 5-days from now. But by that time, they'll be halfway across the Markovian Sea, and ships sailing from Old Karas at that point won't possibly be able to intercept them before they're into the Taro Channel. We might be able to catch them at the southern end of the channel before they cross the Gulf of Matthias, but we'll never stop them from getting into Thol Bay if they decide to do that. And to be honest, even the chance of intercepting them in the gulfs probably no better than even.
We could load them aboard transports and deliver them at sea, Lock Island said.
We could try, Caleb conceded, but we'd run the risk of getting caught by the other side while we were doing it. For that matter, just to get transport galleons to the northern end of the Taro Channel would take a good 4 5-days, Brian, which means Edward would lose 4 of the 8 5-days he's planning on. And according to my numbers, that would cost 6,000 or so of his total.
Maybe we don't have any choice but for me to go call on Admiral Niles the way I did on your father before Darko Sound, Merlin said unhappily.
Forget it, Caleb shook his head. Father was already at sea against an opponent he knew about. Not only that, but it was reasonable, if risky, for him to adopt the strategy he did, given that he knew I was going to be headed back from Armageddon Reef as quickly as I could. But Cody and his entire fleet are headed towards Chisholm to confront a threat there. There is absolutely no logical, reasonable argument he could use to turn the fleet around against his existing orders, even if we were lucky enough for him to take the truth in stride. I think it's probable he would, as a matter of fact, but that doesn't change the fact that if we turn him around without a good solid reason everyone can grasp, no explanation short of demonic or angelic intervention could explain to anyone else, including his own officers and men, why we did it.
He was right, Merlin realized.
All right, Lock Island said. You're right, Your Majesty. We can't turn Cody around, and we don't have 8 5-days to produce shells and ship them to the fleet. So, the way I see it, we only have one real option.
We have an option, really?
The humor in Caleb's voice was biting, but genuine, and the High Admiral chuckled harshly.
I didn't say it was a good option, he pointed out.
All right, in that case, tell us about this not-so-good option.
The way I see it, we're going to have to take the pressure off the Desnarians. I don't want to do that, and if anyone can think of any way we can encourage them to stay home,
despite Maguire's direct orders to sortie, I'll be delighted to hear about it. In the meantime, though, it'll be up to me to sail north. I doubt they're going to just turn around and head home when they see my topsails, but knowing I'm in the area, and not knowing how much of our strength we've sent off to Chisholm in response to their disinformation, they'll have to regard me as a potentially significant threat, at least initially. I'll take enough schooners with me to keep them under close observation, try to make them nervous. With a bit of luck, I should at least be able to instill enough caution to slow them down. On the other hand, if they're feeling frisky and adventurous, I may even be able to tempt them, or some of them at any rate, into chasing me and draw them off. And this will achieve exactly what? Caleb asked, although his tone suggested he was already following his cousin's thinking. While I'm doing that, Dominic will sail for home. We'll be in touch by comm, and we'll both know where the church fleet is. He'll load however many shells Edward's been able to manufacture before he has to pull out. Then, assuming the other side stayed concentrated and I'm still shadowing them, he'll sail to rendezvous with me. If they've divided and sent some of them to pursue me, he'll ignore them and go for the main fleet. He'll be badly outnumbered. Hell, for that matter, we'll be badly outnumbered if both our forces manage to rendezvous before the battle. But he should have at least a few thousand shells in his lockers. If he does, and if we catch them at sea, and if the shells work out as well in practice as Alfred's tests suggest, and if the other side panics when it realizes what we're doing to it, we may manage to turn them back. You do remember how often Father pointed out that a flag officer who builds his strategy based on the assumption that all of it will work the way he expects it to is an idiot, don't you, Brian? Of course I do, and if I had a choice, I wouldn't be suggesting anything of the sort this time either. Unfortunately, I don't think we do have a choice. Brian's right, Your Majesty, Rockpoint said. God only knows how we're going to convince the Desnarians to stay home, or at least make them hesitant enough to let us deal with the Northern Fleet first. But this is the only approach I see which could work, no matter how many things may go wrong with it. And there's this too, I'm afraid. As long as we can avoid a close action that ends up doing to us what Thirsk did to Gwilym, we're no worse off if this doesn't work than we would be if we didn't try to do anything about it at all. And if you don't have enough shells, and if they don't work the way we expect them to, then just how the hell do you plan to avoid that? Caleb demanded. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my powerful intellect suggests to me that to get into your range of them, you have to come into their range of you. Which means the only way you're going to find out you don't have enough shells, or that they don't work the way we expected them to, is going to put you into exactly that sort of an engagement. That may be what happens, Lock Island said quietly. If it does, though, then it does. And you'll still have 2/3 of the Navy to come back and do something about it.